Welcome to the Epic Echo, a podcast designed to reflect the lives and voices of our community and hosted by the Eastern Panhandle Empowerment Center, bringing you new episodes every month, all hosted by me, Nora Frazier. The content of today's episode may be difficult or triggering for some listeners to hear. If you need support, please call our 24/7 helpline at 304-263-8292.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Epic Echo. I'm your host, Brittany, and today we have some very special guests here from the Eastern Panhandle Empowerment Center. Melissa, if you would like to introduce yourself and your role here first, and then Katie, if you would like to do the same.
Sure. So my name is Melissa Kinchelo, and I am something called a Sexual Assault Response Team Community Coordinator, also known as a SART Coordinator, and I'm also the Lead Advocate with EPIC.
And I'm Katie Spriggs, and I'm the Executive Director of EPIC.
Awesome. So the reason we're all here today is, of course, to discuss our event. So first, I'm going to explain a little bit about the event, and then if you guys want to jump in as well for commentary about the event and its purpose. But basically, what we did is on February 29th, we had a homicide reduction community forum in Martinsburg at the Berkeley County Public Library. We had a bunch of people present there, a bunch of different agencies. We had some people from the Berkeley County Prosecuting Office. We had people from the Berkeley County Sheriff's Department, Martinsburg City Police, people represented from EPIC. We had Bill Eilenfeld, what's his technical title?
U.S. Attorney.
Yeah, I always forget that. U.S. State's Attorney. And we had Joe Elliott from the CAV to talk about the Batterer Intervention Program and someone to represent from ATF. So we had a bunch of people there to discuss a lot of things, but our main thing was talking about how there's been a couple of domestic violence homicides in Berkeley County and how each of these agencies play different roles around that and what we can do differently to better the community, help the community understand what happens when someone reports domestic violence and when it potentially leads to a domestic violence homicide, and just what we can all be doing better and what we can learn from each other and how each agency works.
I think that something that really made the event powerful was kind of how Amanda opened up and began the questions to the panel. If Katie, you want to kind of expand on things with Amanda a little bit more, just because I know that you were in communication with her.
Yeah, sure. So as the community is probably aware, and as Brittany mentioned, we had two back-to-back domestic violence related homicides in Berkeley County in the month of December. One was a completed domestic violence homicide, and we're not going to talk names or any specifics of these cases, but because both actually still have criminal charges pending, and that it can affect the prosecution. So we're going to talk, you'll note that we're talking vaguely, and that's on purpose. So one was a completed homicide where ex-husband shot and killed his ex-wife and has since been arrested. He is still living. And then the other one was an attempted, it was a ex-boyfriend who shot and injured his ex-girlfriend and then ultimately committed suicide after also harming law enforcement officers. And both of these involved firearms. So that became a very central topic of conversation as well during this panel. But the best friends of the victim that was murdered by her ex-husband had reached out to EPIC and wanted to do something to better communication and better response just in general in our region. So she was really, her sort of requesting some sort of conversation about how to do better is what spawned the whole idea to do the panel. And she opened up the panel by talking just a little bit about her best friend and her best friend's kids and how everyone in the family has been deeply affected by this homicide and how they feel there were parts of the system in which they could have protected the survivor or the victim better, and they didn't. And so that was really how it started, was how, what happened, and how is everyone affected, and how can we do better?
Yeah, I I agree with Melissa. I think that Amanda's statement was really powerful. I loved that she didn't just talk about herself. She talked about other family members and the kids, and the fact that she talked to them to get their reactions around it and then to share it with the community was extremely powerful. It was also really insightful because I feel like when we're thinking about how it's affecting the families, a lot of people think on the superficial level about how it's affecting the children as far as like, you know, they lost their parents, what's next, but not like the emotions behind it or certain thoughts about like, she mentioned how when they realized things were happening and the fact that it was near one of their schools and feelings around that and other, how also how it affected other children, other, like when a domestic violence homicide occurs, if you're someone who grew up in a household with domestic violence as a child and you recognize that, that your first thought might be, is that my parent? I never really thought about that. I thought that was really insightful. Just because it makes me really sad that they would have to think that there were any kids there thinking like, is that my family member? But especially just to think about how deeply it's really affecting the children and the other family members, because I think it's really important that she spoke about how, you know, even though a terrible act was committed, both people are still missed in different ways. And I think a lot of people also don't think about that. They usually think about the victim's family, but she mentioned like the perpetrator's family too. The perpetrator's family is also grieving because they have also lost someone as well.
Yeah, and I think we miss sometimes when we talk about domestic violence homicide impacts on the kids, we've missed that they lost both parents that day. So like, yes, obviously the mom was murdered by the dad, but they also lost their dad. Like there's a good chance dad will probably spend a very long amount of time in prison. And even if he didn't, like that is a relationship that could never come back from that, right? That is permanent traumatic damage to a relationship. Right. And I think she did a really good job of highlighting that as well, that these kids didn't only lose their mom, they lost their dad and they have no parents now. And that's a really difficult, I don't know if she mentioned it, but the kids are also going to have to relocate. So they're losing their school district as well.
Yeah, that's really sad. I think, you know, it's important to look at it from both sides and for the children, because obviously in this, the children are going to be who's the most impacted, just because one parent's dead, the other one, you know, made a life choice and they're going to have to face consequences of that life choice, but the children are going to have to suffer from those consequences for a long time, maybe forever, especially with psychological and emotional issues that they're going to have to deal with. So I did want to talk about how each of us feel that it went. I know personally, I thought that it went really well. I think it was really awesome to see all of the different agencies come together and talk and work together and show the community how the system can work if everyone at those agencies are working together. It doesn't work when we create barriers between the agencies, and there are barriers that exist already that we, of course, will talk about and can accomplish trying to deconstruct, but also when people within the agencies create barriers between themselves and the other agencies just because of different feelings and not having enough compassion for other agencies or wanting to work with them or feelings of ill towards the other places. So I think that we should start somewhere around there.
Yeah,
you can go ahead.
So I definitely feel like the event went well. I think it really shows how important community is. You know, when I think about Amanda and her talking about the children and everything, she even asked like a question was like, how do you think, you know, this has affected the community, you know, as you guys were kind of touching base on it earlier. And I was really happy with the amount of people that showed up and how we were able to have the panelists there and everything. So again, it does just kind of really remind you about how community is important and it's something that people care about. But
yeah,
I also, you know, I don't know, it showed that this is such a important, sensitive topic because there was even a member in the audience who was brave enough to share their story. about some things, and it's a topic that I don't think is really talked about a lot. And I noticed that a lot of the panelists said that Epic was a point of contact that they have a concern. And I would like to really capitalize on the identification that Epic is a resource and try to develop solid, consistent working relationships with everyone on the panelists. Again, I think it went well. I'm glad that the community showed up. Katie, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I've done this work for like 12 years now, all of those years at Epic, and even when it was Shenandoah Women's Center. And I think if this event taught me anything, it's that we have come such a long way from when I started. Because if you would have asked that same group of people who might have been different people, so like the sitting prosecuting attorney wasn't Katie at the time, the fourth in command at Martinsburg City Police wasn't Andrew Garcia at the time. U.S. Attorney wasn't Bill. Like, none of those people were in their seats. But if you had asked the people who were in those seats, then they wouldn't have listed Epic as a referral source. They may not have even known who we were. So I think if anything, it restored my faith a little bit that even though it's really hard, this thing we're doing it well, better than we were. And there is a more collaborative community response now. There are still some holes in this instance, specifically this one instance, the one Amanda was talking about, that victim should have been granted a protective order. It's kind of indisputable at this point. Like, anybody who knows the guidelines for a protective order and hears what was presented would know that that should have been approved. So we talked a lot about a barrier being access to protective orders in the state. And what is that barrier? Is it a code change that needs made legislatively? My personal opinion is that it's not. Is it a magistrate training issue? Is it a accessibility issue? It's difficult in this state to get a protective order in a language other than English. It's difficult in this state to be sure that you are provided with someone who could help you understand it, even if you speak and read English, but maybe not to the level in which the paper is written. There is an access issue in the state. So we talked a little bit about that at the panel, and I think that will be a continued topic that we move forward with. So I think if anything else, another thing I got from the panel was that that is an issue that touches us all, and that everyone was very well. It didn't surprise anybody on the panel or even in the audience that that access is an issue. Like, I don't think that would surprise anyone, statewide, honestly.
Yeah, I feel
Yeah.
like. Sorry, go ahead, Melissa.
Oh, it's okay. No, I was gonna say, yeah, I agree. I think us having the conversation about trying to identify loopholes and barriers and stuff, just to kind of piggyback off what Katie's saying, is like magistrate trainings. You know, what type of trainings do individuals have? What kind of training can Epic provide? I know there was an individual in the audience who had mentioned the LGBTQ community, and if there are existing trainings or whatnot that involve IPV. And when I say IPV, I mean interpersonal violence with that demographic and whatnot, which was an incredibly great question. I was so happy that they had asked that. But I think training is a big one. And just like Katie was talking about, just ease of access. We were talking about how there was a client at Epic once that needed a protective order translated in Spanish. And we were told to go to the Supreme Court in order to get a copy of it. And there was a particular magistrate that was in the audience who said that it's because the Supreme Court are the individuals that make the forms, you know, and it just makes you think like, okay, they might make the forms, but what about ease of access to that? You know, why is that not printed out or dispersed to be at magistrate courts and courthouses and whatnot? But just having those conversations, I thought was important. But to me, I always think that training is always a good thing. So I was glad that we brought that up.
Yeah, I fully agree with both of you, especially what you just said, Melissa, about like having to have ease of access to things, and the fact that you bring up a great question about why aren't there protective orders in different languages? But why are we the ones asking the questions? You know, as magistrates, yes, you don't make them, but it's not like somebody hasn't come across in your court space where you know that they don't speak English and they need access in a different language. Like, why isn't everyone calling and asking why we don't have access to these, especially people who are responsible for denying or granting them? You know, it's not just on one person to find solutions to it.
Yeah, and
I agree. I'm
a huge proponent for training too, Melissa, as well. I think it helps. I think it opens your mind to a different way of thinking about something, and it might draw your attention to something you hadn't thought of. But I think there's also a component of it that is culture change. Like, it is unacceptable. Like you said, Brittany, why did this group of people find it completely unacceptable that the emergency protective order paperwork isn't necessarily accessible depending on where you are in the state, and other people maybe find that as a back burner issue? Like, yeah. What's that? What, you know, what's that barrier? What's that difference? Is it that some people are centering cultural responsiveness and some people don't find it important? Is it that they've never thought about it, right? Like, what is it? So I think at some point it does come down to culture change and people in positions of power having to say, we aren't going to do it that way anymore. And that's just going to be how it is. And I think there's a training component to that, but there's also a climate component to that. Like, we got to change the climate around these things and how they're discussed and who is centered and whose needs are centered. Because that it, I think it was Keegan in the office, in the audience, he is a fellow board member of mine on Shoulder to Shoulder, which is the first culturally specific domestic violence program in the state, based out of Charleston. And yeah, Keegan is a fellow board member. They also work at Marshall University. And I think it was them that asked the question. And I was really happy that they asked that as well. I felt the same way, because it was like, we're having all this discussion about these cases that we did really bad. Like, we messed up, we missed steps, but also what about the most marginalized? Like, what are we doing in general? So I thought, I agreed, Melissa. I thought that was a great question. I was glad that they were there and they asked it.
Yeah, I was really thankful that everyone was able and willing to discuss different barriers. I mean, first of all, I was really happy that we had almost 50 people show up on a Thursday night from 6 to 8:30, like at the library. That's pretty good, especially for an event that we're hosting, because a lot of people don't want to go to sad events talking about domestic violence, homicides. So the people that show up wanted to be there, they wanted to help make a difference. And I applaud the panelists for attending and being open and honest about the fact that there are things that each of us can do better. And the biggest thing that I think I got as a takeaway was training. And of course, a lot of people talked about how Epic does the trainings and, you know, if we just train more, which we can do, but we also talked about barriers of, well, each of these agencies have to be, one, willing to let us train, two, have to have the time, you know, such as like police officers in our area are understaffed. You know, they don't have time to go do trainings. If they're only required, let's say they're mandated 16 hours. I don't know the exact number, but let's just say they're mandated 16 hours a year, you know, and they don't have the time or the other employment officers who can cover for them to be able to do more training, then we can only do what we can in those 16 hours. So it's like, there's got to be a better system to where we can set aside more time and develop. And I think we have come up with a little bit of a better system. I know Melissa and I have worked recently specifically with the Berkeley County Sheriff's Department. We did some training there, and maybe the solution is just small groups when you can, and we reach out more often and we do small groups at each of the agencies for prosecuting attorneys, for magistrates, for police officers, for ATF officers, anything that we can. Obviously the biggest thing that we talked about was training for magistrates, but I think a lot of things that people discussed and didn't super focus on was the fact that we can only give trainings when people come to and want to participate in the trainings. Something that really resonated with me was one lady speaking about how, you know, all of this starts early, so if we're in the schools more. But of course, I know, and I didn't make the comment, but I thought about raising my hand and commenting back to her, but I was like, no, I'm not going to. About how, like, Melissa and I reached out to probably like 25 schools for teen dating violence and healthy relationships for February, which wasn't the exact topic we were covering, but it does count as intimate partner violence. And out of the 25 schools, we had 3 reach back for Berkeley, Morgan, and Jefferson County. So like, you want us to do trainings, but people aren't letting us in to do the trainings. And maybe it's that we're reaching out to the wrong people. Maybe we need to try more teacher specific, but the teachers still have to get it approved from people who aren't allowing us into the schools.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely a barrier that not only, you know, have I experienced with trying to reach out to a particular county to get into their schools. A lot of the nonprofits and other agencies and that I work with have such a hard time getting in. And kind of to go back into talking about how, you know, IPV is a community solution and a community issue. If you, and I absolutely agree that prevention is a core component, where if you're in there early in schools and working with youth, that that's the most important time to really do that. So in barriers, like, why is it so difficult for us to go into schools, to work with schools? You know, in some counties, they'll be like, yep, come on through, please. We see it. We appreciate the need. And the other counties won't even respond. They don't even humor it. Or unless there's like a PR thing going on. And then all of a sudden, you know, we're involved for a hot second and we disappear, you know. And kind of just going back also to training with magistrates, like how do we hold them accountable for taking the trainings? You know, how do we make sure that they're actually doing it? And I know that there is a particular magistrate who was in attendance there as well that had personally reached out for trainings on IPV, which was wonderful. And they had mentioned that they would try to send it out to the other magistrates. But of course, you know, who knows if they're actually going to watch it or not. But why is there not some kind of standard where all magistrates are trying to get training, up-to-date training on interpersonal violence and everything? Because also, you know, I say this all the time in so many of my trainings that Brittany and I do, like, as times evolve and technology evolves, so do victimization. So are magistrates getting, you know, training on stalking online? Do they know what stalking is? Because a lot of victims that of stalking don't even realize they are victims of stalking. How often do they get training? Who do they get it from? How do we hold them accountable for that? I just think that's important, because if you're going to be granting, you know, protective orders, you know, you should be really kept up to date and current on information like that.
Yeah, and it's frightening to me that that domestic violence as a whole isn't centered as the life, like the death risk that it is. So it's like one of the leading causes of death among women in the United States. And it is the leading cause of homelessness among women in the United States. It accounts for 30% of all violent crime. And the most likely thing to kill a child is a gun in the United States. So like, this is a problem. Like this is a problem that affects almost every single person, either directly or secondarily in this country. And the state of West Virginia has some of the risk factors that even increase it. So like living in poverty is a risk factor that could increase domestic violence. Having a one partner income and one partner stays at home is a child abuse, experiencing childhood abuse is a common, you know, denominator. So I think what frustrates me after, like, you know, the decade of doing it is that it still fights to be at the table for one of these like humanitarian things that we need to be focusing on as a country. In 2000, I'll never forget 2016, during the presidential election, so I will preface this to say, interpersonal violence is not political. It is a subject matter that should be and is often centered as a need maybe not as high of a need as we would like, but centered as a need by both all political parties. And so it doesn't follow party lines. But I will just never forget that one of the most impactful moments in my career, in 2016, I was sitting at a table with all of the program directors for all of the domestic violence programs in the state when we found out that the incoming presidential proposed budget eliminated all violence against women funding. The VAWA line item was gone. And violence against women funding is the first federal funding stream that centered sexual violence. And it was the first federal funding stream that centered this idea of a coordinated community response, this like SART team idea. And in the 90s, and it's been reauthorized, you know, all the years since then, and it was eliminated from the presidential. I mean, obviously that didn't happen. Like, you know, we're, you know, 8 years later and we still have funding, but it was scary to me that this was an easy line item to eliminate. Like, oh, we don't need that. Like, as if it's not life saving. Right. And I think that's the core of the issue. Like, we need everybody who focuses on this issue or intersects with this issue to see it as what it is. You know, life, death, risk, life saving services that if they were taken away, that number, well, we would see it be even higher. Like, if services left and if people stopped worrying about it, that we would see death increase dramatically, particularly among women and children, because domestic violence homicides aren't often only limited to the victim. Like, domestic violence perpetrators kill kids too. So like, and kill themselves. Right. So I think we're, you know, missing whole pieces of this, because I think part of it is that we're desensitized to it because of culture.
I agree.
We're just like, it's everywhere. It's in every movie. It's a joke. It's the butt of a joke. It's not, and I'm not, I, there is no science to back it up. And I'm not a personal believer that video games or movies or TV shows or whatever cause violence, but it does desensitize you to violence, right? Like, that is what it does. So it's like, we're so flooded with hearing about it so often, either actual stories, like reading it in the newspaper, read the crime report one time. There's like 15 domestic battery cases. That mm-hmm. is literally somebody striking another person. And I think we just desensitize to it. We're like, oh, 15 domestic batteries. Okay, it's just a misdemeanor. And we don't like think through the actual, what does it mean when someone is charged with domestic battery? Right. Like, what's the effects of that?
And something that, you know, humbly, it doesn't feel good to say this, is I think a lot of the first responders that work with victims of, you know, domestic violence and sexual violence, like, we get desensitized in a sense as well, where we need to really self-reflect on that and understand that we need to not lose that sense of humanity, at least, you know, from particular working relationships that I've had. You know, everyone seems like there's just burnout all around in all of first responders. And I think it was great that people really showed up to the event and that the first responders showed up. And I thought it was really great for a particular law enforcement officer to talk about, like, you know, hearing these stories really affects me too, you know. Right. So, you know, how do we work on being not desensitized or, you know, hanging on to that humanity and the mission of why we're there, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And oh, go ahead, Brittany.
I mean, I think the first thing that we can do, which is what we did, is talk about it more. Like, a lot of mm-hmm. the reasons people are desensitized to it is that they see it. We see it every day. It's on the news constantly. We know that people are dying. We know it's an epidemic in the United States, but no one wants to focus on the core root of it, because it's something that's just happening, but we're not talking about why is it happening? How can we do things better? You know, and that's something that we did. We planned this event so that people could talk about their different roles. I mean, a lot of the people there probably knew what each agency had to do with domestic violence homicide, because they're there because they care and they have a stake in it. But there definitely were audience members who, such as, like, I brought my husband. You know, he knows what I do, but he doesn't know a lot about all the things and the intersecting agencies. Yeah. And people that show up that don't really know definitely learn a lot, and they learn that the different roles of the agencies and how they can do things better as a community. And the main thing is just we have to be willing to talk about the issue. It's such a taboo topic that people are terrified to talk about because, you know, it's sad or we don't want to talk about it or, you know, it's really not that important because if it was important, people would focus on it more. And I think Katie addressed that really well, was talking about how, you know, people don't focus on it because they feel like it's a back burner issue and there are other things that need to come first. And maybe that comes down to a lack of training of, you know, we need to talk more about it because this is what's happening. Here's the statistics. Here's what we know. Also, you know, let's talk about trauma that affects the victim when it happens, trauma on the brain, trauma for other people involved. I think a great thing that we discussed is how, you know, first responders as well and community members have trauma from these events. It's not just the victim and the perpetrator. It's also community members and first responders that respond to the scene and, you know, victim advocates that are helping afterwards and friends and family and people that don't even know them who are like, wow, this is happening in my community. You know, we had a community response of people reaching out because they're like, we've had three recently. You know, this is a spike. This is big. We should talk about it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the members of that team of the panel that do it really well. So like when we communicate really well,
yeah,
it makes a better outcome for everybody. And I know I said that like 82 times during the panel, but the only thing I've ever seen work is coordinated community response. It doesn't work when you try to tackle this in a silo. It can't just be us out here, you know, advocating for victims and then the prosecutors prosecuting cases over there by themselves without talking to us. And then like, that doesn't work. And like Katie's office or the Berkeley County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, I work with them a lot as an expert witness and a consultant. And one of the things that they're really, really good at, every single one of them that I've ever worked with, all the assistant prosecutors, is even if they have a really difficult case. So if they have a case where maybe the victim has stopped cooperating, maybe they, recanted, maybe they said I don't want to go through with this, they'll often call me and just kind of talk through it and be like, okay, here's everything I did, you know, try to coordinate with the victim, here's the evidence, here's, you know, my position as a prosecutor is that I have to prosecute crime and I, you know, have reason to believe that this crime did happen. So right. Like, do I go forward without them? Do we do a victimless prosecution? How do we do that as gently as possible? What does the science say about doing those? Which, by the way, we have a statewide, it's, I'm laughing because the name of the team isn't going to make any sense when I say it. And then I'm going to have to explain it, which is going to make it even more funny. But it's two different training teams. We have two different training teams that are made up of every training team has a victim advocate, a prosecuting attorney, and a law enforcement officer. And we train as a team. And the training content is set each year by not only the training team members, but also like other invested parties. So there's probably like 15 victim advocates that aren't actually trainers, but they're consultants and they consult on the curriculum. And those training teams are called the RACS team, which is like specifically for rural counties. So it's like rural access to criminal and civil systems or something. I think that's what RACS stands for. And those trainings only occur in rural counties. And then there's the ICJR team, which is the one I was laughing at because it doesn't make any sense. But it's the name of the grant. It's like increasing crime response. I don't even remember, but that's the name of the grant, which is why it's so weird. And that they can train anywhere in the state. That team can train anywhere in the state. And we were at a training team meeting earlier this year, and we're reviewing some new research that was talking about what longtime survivors found effective. So these are like, they're 10 years out at this point. And one of the things they found effective was, this is going to hurt us, this is going to hurt victim advocates to hear, because it hurt me to hear, was forced services. So when they were forced into treatment, or their prosecution went on without them, it was a victimless prosecution. They found that effective because they were like, I wasn't ready to take the step yet, but someone forced me to take it. Now, for those of us who operated on an empowerment model, we're like, no, yeah. we're not going to do that. But I think there is some value in just like talking with survivors about maybe there's a better way to do that. Like, right. Maybe there's a better way to force services, for lack of a better word, that's not as forced, right? But I thought that research was interesting because it was like, okay, victimless prosecutions can happen in a way that we are minimizing harm to all parties. Yeah. We just got to figure out what that looks like. And the best way to do it is in a team. And the best way to do it was open communication. Cause like when the assistant prosecutors call them and I'm talking to them and they're like kind of beating their head against the wall and almost like apologizing. Like, I don't know what I'm like, hey, don't apologize. This is a really hard thing you're doing. Domestic violence is a complex situation. Like you're tackling this humongous thing that is so much bigger than both of us. And so I think sometimes it even just helps them to talk through it with someone else who like understands that this is really hard. And I think that can be really beneficial to them. And I think we shouldn't underestimate the benefit of that from the team approach either. It's just the peer support of it all.
Yeah. So my next question, I think we covered, did we learn anything? But if there's anything you want to add to that, did you learn anything that you didn't already know that we haven't discussed currently? I know for me, I learned that we need to do more training and I learned more about the intersections of the system because out of the three people on this video chat, I am the newest to this world. And, you know, I know who does and doesn't work together for this, but it was really nice to see everyone come together and learn more about each agency's specific role. But for you all, did you learn anything?
For me, in terms of, I don't know, I guess the insight that I got, it kind of made me realize that, you know, having a conversation that was more of, I mean, of course it was professional, but still a conversation where everyone was on the same page, showed the humanity in all of us, including the panelists. And I think that, just like Katie was talking about, if there isn't like a cohesive, strong community connection to work on things, then I don't know what the solution would be without that. And it kind of makes me, you know, wonder like, how can I create more safe spaces on a professional yet more human level with all of the other panelists?
Yeah.
How can I do my part in the community and grow to create a more humane and functioning connection with all the other first responders of all the other agencies and nonprofits and whatnot that could really, really be helpful in addressing, you know, concerns with IPV in the community. So it's kind of just showing me insight of how I, what my part is, because I think that's important for everyone to understand, is that how can you grow without being humble and understanding where you can grow? And I think it showed me as a community coordinator that I need to create those opportunities a lot more.
Yeah, one thing I found effective, you have to be extremely not burnt out to do it, I will say, is anytime, one time when we did these ICJR RACS trainings, which is all around the state, in our little team, one time we opened the training with like, okay, let's just get the elephant out of the room. What is the most difficult part of prosecuting these cases? Recanting, that's difficult. Yeah. Victims not cooperating, that's difficult. So like, what, let's just get it out. Like, what are we frustrated about? And I think that was really helpful, kind of like you said, Melissa, to meet the human part, the part that doesn't necessarily understand this. And especially the part that thinks that if it was happening to us, we wouldn't respond this way. Yeah. That's like, you just gotta be like, it didn't happen to you in this incident, in this way, in this context, with this life experience, right? And you have to take yourself out of it. And I think that's trainable. That you gotta learn that though, because it's not human nature. Human nature is to, in order to feel empathy, you put yourself in the situation. And then you don't feel empathy if someone reacted in a way that you didn't think you would. But like, that's not how this works, right? And I think that is helpful, but you have to do it with tact because it can turn into just like an event session real quick. But again, I think you're right. I think we have to see our fellow first responders as peers and people who are working toward the same goal as us, and then hold each other accountable when we fail or when we don't do it well, and hold each other accountable with respect, which is also a learning behavior, because that's hard.
I definitely agree. I think it's, you are able to hold each other and hold yourself accountable respectfully, you know, because it's all of us with the same goal, just different branches, if you will, you know, to meet that goal. And yeah, I just think that I appreciate you, Katie, talking about how like addressing the burnout thing. And I think that's very, very true. And Katie, you just mentioned about how like you have to kind of control that it doesn't, turn into something that's just completely a vent session. It's okay to vent. We should vent. That's part of the human aspect of the conversation, but we need to conclude it with a plan, an action-based plan. So we hear each other out, but what are we going to do about it? What are
Yeah,
we going to try?
and the venting can't harm survivors. So it's like vent respectfully, which I don't know that that's a
Yes.
term that's ever been said before, but we should make it a t-shirt.
Yeah.
I love it.
So did either of you receive, because I know like I wasn't really in charge of this event, so I didn't have a lot of communication with community members or anything like that. Were there any community responses after the event about people who attended in the audience or even panelists, and were they on the same boat as us about how things went? They thought things went well, or were there any comments from people who felt like things could have been done differently?
I had a couple of the panelists, and I know Melissa's touched base with them, say that they were going to be their organization's representative on the sexual assault response team, which is kind of big because
Yes.
that's helpful, is if there's one rep instead of a different person every meeting.
Yeah.
So I think that's big news. I talked with Amanda, the victim's best friend, afterwards, and she thought it went really well, and she's definitely interested in doing similar things down the line. I think one of the things that she's interested in doing in the future that would be very, very beneficial to the county is once this case is done. So like once this case is prosecuted, because right now it can't be talked about like in an open setting.
Right.
But once it can, one of the things that she had said the family wanted to do was to create like a multidisciplinary training that follows this case example. So like using this real life case example, here's
Yeah.
what happened. Here's the 911 call. Here's the DVPO that was denied. Here's the second DVPO that was denied. Here, like all of those things. And talking about like, okay, here the system worked really well. Here's why it worked well. Here the system didn't work so well. Why didn't it work so well? So I think that could be really beneficial.
Yeah.
And that was really her feedback was like, cool, this was really cool. Like, how do we keep going? She said she was impressed with the panel's ability to tackle this really hard conversation while still holding each other accountable. So I'm glad that that came across to people in the audience, not just us. I did hear from a few other audience members, one who was concerned by some like victim blaming comments that were made by like a different audience member, which I think we did a good job rerouting like in the moment. But there was some conversation around the culture around victim blaming. I don't know that other than that, both Bill and Katie, just both the prosecutors, federal and state, were just like, this is so great. I'm glad we did it. So I think all around good feedback that I heard.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm gonna agree. I don't I think Katie is a lot more connected than
Yeah.
I am. Katie is queen, but I heard good feedback afterwards talking to a couple of people in the audience and whatnot. So I definitely think it went well.
Yeah, a couple of the audience members, I heard as they were leaving saying that they felt like the event went really well and they were thankful and they'd like to have another one, which brings me to my last question. One, do you feel like there's anything we can do differently at Epic now that we know more? And two, would we do another one of these events?
So I would love to have more community discussion. I hope that we don't have to have this particular type of event because of what stemmed it from it. You know what I mean? Or like
Yes.
how this event even had to happen in the first place. But I do think that community discussions and forums are incredibly important and should be a lot more implemented. And I'm sorry, what was the first part of your question? What do you think Epic can do better or
Yeah,
differently?
now that we've learned some things about how different agencies interact and heard from different panelists and community members about things that they would like to see going forward. Was there anything specifically that resonated with you that you feel like we could do differently?
For me, I think it kind of goes back into creating more opportunities to have that conversation with first responders and people on the panelists and whatnot to really meet them where they are. Because I know for me, at least, I mean, this is all aspects of IPVRs, things I care about that I am trained on, that I do know about. And I have to understand that all the other individuals are not, you know, necessarily aware, like Katie was talking about earlier, about like, well, I wouldn't have acted like that if that had happened to me. Well, that is a trainable thing, because you can teach about trauma on the brain, how victims' brains are physically changed in the moment and how there's long-term consequences and stuff. But having opportunities to meet them where they are, identify what needs there are, they may not even know that they need a training in that. You know, why would they? How, you know, without us having a conversation and identifying things like that. So for me, I think it's just learning more to have more consistent conversations with the key community members of people that interact and respond to victims of interpersonal violence. So that's for me, is how can I be more introspective to meet not only the clients that we work with where they are, but the professionals that we work with and collaborate with on behalf of the victims, for the victims, how do I meet them where they are? So that's for me. I don't even necessarily know if that's EPIC as an agency. That's just something that I personally think that we could kind of do. But that's also, again, me, not the agency. The agency does
that.
I think my takeaway for EPIC as a whole, and I think of things at very strange times. So I don't know that this thought that I had during the panel is actually like relevant to the panel. But when Amanda was talking, one of the things that she talked about was the financial impact of this domestic violence homicide on the family, that was still going on. And I had been in conversation with her for like a month before, maybe more than that, before this, and it had never dawned on me, the longest serving employee, to offer the Crime Victims Fund. But then somehow in the moment when she said it, I was like, oh, Crime Victims Fund. And I wrote it like on a little thing to Melissa. I was like, Crime Victims Fund. Like, I don't even know why I wrote it to Melissa. I was just like, guess what I thought of? Like, I had to tell her. and Katie, the prosecutor, was sitting on the other side of Melissa and was like, yeah, Crime Victims Fund. Like, so all of us were kind of thinking about it at the same time. And for some reason, that me forgetting about that until the moment of, and also realizing that no one else had told them, right? So like the prosecuting attorney's office hadn't told them either. And like, these are things that we both should have remembered. And so then my mind went to, I think EPIC has gotten so big that it's impossible for every single employee to like know every single resource. Like it's, I forgot about it. And I would be the one that would be training one of the ones that would be training people on this. So like, what, how do we figure that out? So I was like pondering over like, how do we make sure stuff like that doesn't fall through the cracks anymore? And something I thought of was, what if we created a list of projects, for lack of a better word, and different staff members at EPIC take lead on different projects. So like, okay, somebody could be lead on, you know, the Crime Victims Fund and making sure that every advocate fully understands it and making sure that it has repeated training and making sure that if there's any changes to the Crime Victims Code or leadership or website, that they know and they send those updates out to the rest of the staff. So I think this EPIC was formed in one way of operating an organization, and we've gotten so big that that way doesn't work anymore. So we have to come up with ways that we can all take leadership on different things and, you know, be responsible for making sure that that's disseminated. So I don't know that that is directly related to the forum, but that was what I thought about afterwards. Yeah. And we have a sexual assault directors, all the sexual assault program directors are getting together at the end of this month. And I want to bring it up in that forum and just talk like through logistics, like what logistically would that look like, and then probably bring it to the greater, you know, EPIC staff. We have an in-person staff meeting in May. So I was thinking of making that one of the bigger topics of that staff meeting. But that's what hit me during the forum. Don't know if it really has anything to do with it, but it is what I thought of.
No, I think
it's relevant, Katie.
Yeah,
it's relevant.
Yeah, it's relevant and it's important. And I think another thing we could look at doing is maybe not necessarily adjusting, but adding to the intake form. Like we could add a section of like literally a checklist of resources and services that we know that we are potentially able to offer. Or because I know some will ask, like there's specific questions on there about asking like, would you want legal aid or would you want? So maybe it would be like, I'm not saying that you qualify for this, but go ahead through this checklist of 20 items and check off the ones that you would be interested in. If you qualify, would you be interested in crime victim funding compensation? Would you be interested in legal aid? Would you be interested in homeless resources? Would you be interested in mental health resources? Maybe you are interested in learning about like new churches in the area, like just a list of things that like we know we have access to that we could then case management plan with them after the intake and the crisis management planning.
So I think there is kind of like a little bit of a checklist there that is on our intake that addresses like if you need housing or if you need employment or whatnot. But I think what would be really great from what you were talking about, Brittany, is like if there's a checklist that's like, are you interested in Vine services? You know, downloading the Vine app. Do you know what that is? You know, Let me explain to you. Are you in need of the victim compensation fund? You know?
And then if the advocate who does the intake is like, what the hell is Vine? They can call the Vine project lead.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Had to pipe my own idea for the project lead in there.
But yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking, Katie. Like all those project leads, like there's a little section on our intake to be like, you know, screening and asking clients if they're interested in those. Because I always think that screening is super, super important, especially because there's so much that even victims themselves don't know about. And without the community, without those resources, without, you know, everything like that, that we should be able to really utilize and make. I think that's a great idea, putting that on our intake. Look, this is great. We're already having a conversation.
Well, and I think a checklist is also like a small comprehensive way of being like, you know, someone who's in crisis cannot answer all the questions. And, you know, there are a lot of resources that we can offer, but we're not focused on in the moment because if you're doing an intake, you're in crisis, you're here for a reason. But if we have them just go through a mini checklist during that, once we're through the crisis, we can then sit down as case managers and be like, okay, so these are the things you checked off. And you can decide now that we've handled the crisis situation, do you want access to this? Do you want services? Do you want all of these things that they can access that we know we have resources to, but we don't typically discuss in the beginning? I think that could be a simple way of having them show their interest in those services.
And then I think for follow-up for the like the panelists, like the other first responders, is maybe now that we're like processing this aloud, maybe the three of us could hold a Zoom like in a month, be like, okay, it's 2 months post, you know, forum. What is your agency doing? Have you talked about this differently? Have you thought about your responses differently? Have you attended your first SART meeting? Like maybe we could follow up with the panelists and just be like, what are you doing since that panel to like change your organization or your agency?
Yeah.
And maybe that's an ongoing thing.
Well, it appears we have run out of time, ladies, but I want to thank you all for being here and for participating and having great conversations with us. Is there any other last minute commentary, anything you want to add?
No, just to thank everybody for attending and for listening if you were unable to attend. And to just remember that this touches every single person. So everybody has a hand in making it better too.
Yeah.
I think I would just like to add that if there's anybody that is a victim or survivor of domestic violence or any form of interpersonal violence and they're listening to this, if there are things that you think personally from your experiences that could improve things. I mean, your voice is what's important. Your voice is significantly a part of the solution. And I know it can be difficult to, you know, especially if you're in a community forum, it can be really, really difficult to share your experiences, your thoughts and whatnot. So if there's anybody that's listening that has thoughts, suggestions, please feel free to email Epic so that we can hear you because your voice matters.
All right.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Epic Echo. To suggest topic ideas, guest recommendations, or even just to ask questions you'd like us to answer on air, please find us on social media at the Epic Echo Podcast or on our website at epicwv.org/epic-echo.